first on the...
I think members will get going. We don't have a quorum yet, but Ms. Halbeck, you can continue. Could you remind us, Ms. Halbeck, what page we're on?
Mr. Chair, yes. We are on page 16.
16.
At the bottom.
Halbeck, please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We are on objective A1B, talking about reducing the overall emissions of volatile organic chemicals in the air over Minnesota by 2018. And we right now are projected to meet those goals, which are part of our overall multi-reduction for energy and keeping us within attainment. It relies on us to do pollution prevention work and to look at non-point source. And I thought, and you'll see kind of where we are if you change to the top of page 17, we're 12 and 13, where we're really looking at the ozone issues and volatile organic chemicals as they matter relative to our attainment. But I thought I would highlight yesterday we had a little bit of discussion on where FTEs are, and it's not perfectly clear on the spreadsheet, but if you look to the left-hand column, you'll see a number of 93.2 on the spreadsheet. That's the FTEs that really are the permitting and modeling and air, and so that's part of where you'll see that a lot of our air folks are based on the point source and managing the permits and the compliance area up here. So where we were looking at small chunks of FTE in those R goals when we were talking about prevention, this is really one of the bigger chunks of the work that we do. And it's because it is related to how we set up permits and reduce emissions through those permits. So then I will drop to the bottom of page 17, which is our A2 goal, the outdoor air quality. And this is really important relative to human health impacts. And as you look to the top of page 18, where we're really looking at, this is some of our more recent air modeling and where we've seen the risks associated with transportation and outdoor burning. And if you look in the air report that I mentioned earlier yesterday, you will start to see where those impacts are. And air currently, the impacts are not around our point source, which you would think of as the industrial stacks. But it really is transportation, open burning barrels, what we do in our backyards when we have burning going on there, where people don't just burn firewood all the time. They add components to it.
Thank you, Ms. Halbeck. We'll officially bring the meeting to order. Continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So in FY 2012 and 13, what we're going to be doing, working on this, is actually furthering what we our basic model in this area, which is called MinRisk. And certainly that to explain that complete model to you is beyond me. That's where we would have to bring the experts from the agency into you. But that will allow us to really target where we want to see the reductions. And so not using broad-based, same standard for everyone to meet every target, but really focus in on it. And when you look at the results of that model, it really shows it's the transportation zones in the metro area that we have to think about. And then those communities that are right along those major arteries, like the Phillips neighborhood and some of those in the inner city. So that's where you're going to start to see our work focus in and working with those communities and what we can do better. On the bottom of page 18, where we have really we have a requirement because we are grouped at the federal level with other states. In our case, we're grouped with the central states, and so we have a requirement that we have to reduce our portion of it. And so this goal is really what do we do relative to mercury and the other activities that make a difference as the wind blows across Minnesota to other states. In the air, you're not only impacted what is in your local area, but also from the climate as it in the wind directions as it moves across. So we really have a job to do, not as much as other areas because we've been proactive and our industries have been very active in this area, but reducing our mercury, and particularly as it might impact the boundary waters in some of those areas, which is why mining is very important as we're working with them. We have just about completed a new emissions database, which will allow the industries both to report in electronically but also see their data coming back out. So they're starting to put the information in, and we're completing the ability for them to report out, which will give us better data to look at this. And again, the idea is to target what we're doing, not have a broad brush standard that hits everybody the same, and then figure out with those industries what we can do. On the bottom of page 19, this is where we have some requirements in the state to reduce greenhouse gases based on the Next Generation Energy Act that was passed in 2007. And so this would continue our work with that, which is really the reporting component of it, which our emissions database would allow, and see where we are, particularly as we're working with our permitted facilities as a first start on that. I'm moving to page 20. At the bottom of that, which is the visibility impairment in the boundary waters, we have a need to reduce that by 6% in 2018. And we do have camera shots of what that haze looks like to it. We do receive complaints about people who camp and use the boundary waters and what they're able to see. They recall when they could see certain things in the earlier years and can't see as much now. And this really is a national, because the boundary waters is a national, that we have some standards to do. And EPA has our plan on what to do, and they have not yet approved it, and they've had it for over a year. So that really sets the stage once they approve it. Again, doing a good reduction in our nitrous oxides and the sulfur dioxides in northeast Minnesota will help, and that means that we have to work with the mining because they're one of the larger, and then some of the power plants that are up there. And the mining, as we have been proceeding in permitting and environmental review with the mining companies, they've been well aware of this coming down, and so they've been planning for that in the environmental review and permitting process. This will not be new to them. And then I'm moving on to page 21, where we will be leaving the air goals and moving to the land goals. So this will now start where we think about solid waste, hazardous waste, and our Superfund and remediation programs. That's what's managed under here. So the first effort is to really think about solid waste as a resource, not only as an energy resource, but as a material resource in which we can produce other things from that. We have seen that over in the past 4 or 5 years, actually, the production of solid waste is down, and that's really economy-based. When I ran both the recycling center and the landfill, you can see the economy. People start throwing away less, and they start to recycle more. And then you can see the change in the type of waste. And the waste experts would really tell you information about it. When you're really seeing the waste, you can tell a lot. But 70% of the waste in Minnesota is generated in the four centroids that we talked about yesterday, the metropolitan area here in the Twin Cities, Duluth, Rochester, and St. Cloud. So that's where we're focusing, again, our efforts to help those look at ways to reduce the waste, increase recycling, look at composting, and then ultimately whatever you have to do to dispose of the remainder part of it. So I just noted a couple of things. We talked about these yesterday, about a couple of the composting projects and what they're able to achieve. Western Lake Sanitary District, which does not only solid waste but works on wastewater, I'm on the top of page 22 now, has received a grant from us to improve their composting pad that they use not only for the residences, but they also have quite an effort going on with the businesses, and it's saving the businesses money. So they wanted to improve that so that they could actually receive larger trucks and be able to manage it in a productive way. And that was one of the grants given from money received in the last biennium towards composting grants. So Western Lake received one of those.
Ms. Hallbeck, which fund specifically did those grants come from that you gave out? Where was the source of that money?
The source of that is from the Environmental Fund, which you can look to the solid waste tax as being part of that fund.
Thank you.
I'm going to drop down to the bottom of page 22. In reducing the number of households who burn their waste on site. Again, this would, we think of the burn barrels in the backyard that probably a few of us have grown up with. I had one on the farm when I grew up, and we now know more about what was in those barrels when we were burning it, not just the smoke that came out of it, but the dioxins and the other health impacts from those. So we have a targeted effort to continue to reduce it, and when we look at the budget slides, we'll show you where we are on target and moving down to reduce that. On the top of page 23, this hits a little bit to the conversation we were having yesterday.
Representative Hansen has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Hallbeck, on the on-site burning, I'm looking at the map and I see that Anoka County and Dakota County don't have resolutions on the no burn. And just checking, is that just a long-standing thing, or have they debated that or looked at that in those two counties recently? I would think with changes in population and smoke flying, that have they looked at it recently?
Ms. Hallbeck.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't know how recently they've looked at it. I do know that the Solid Waste Management Board that meets around the metro area has talked about it, but particularly in the counties, I'm not sure. We could go back and ask the staff that actually work with them.
Thank you. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Hallbeck, is the burn barrel efforts, are those targeted or are those on a statewide basis?
Ms. Hallbeck.
Mr. Chair, the marketing and the education is statewide, but it's really working within the counties that have the larger issues and who have expressed some concerns that we then need to work with them and how to achieve it. So it is still targeted to the larger. We certainly aren't going to start in Kitson County with little of the population to move. We would, again, as Representative Hansen brought up, you're going to work in the higher populations because that's where the greatest public risk will, and then move from there. But it really is with the counties. It's not separate from it. It's not an effort that we're out there policing. We have no one who's doing, you know, inspections from place to place. As we get complaints, we might investigate it, but again, it's working with the county. It's a county ordinance that's required on that map. So it's really, we're helping with the education and the outreach material so that the counties can implement it.
Thank you.
Continue, Ms. Hallbeck.
Again, Mr. Chair, on the top of page 23, mentioned I thought perhaps this would get to a little bit of the discussion we had yesterday about moving targets and the issues with groundwater and where we are. The groundwater requirements for solid waste are in the rules and have been in those rules since 1988. It's not a moving target on what the standard is there. What does change over time as the Department of Health gets more information and changes the health risks, then what becomes of more of a concern from what you have to do when you hit the target in the rule, which isn't called an intervention limit, which is well below the health limits. That's the point of it, is to that you can do something to modify it before it becomes a problem. So that is what we're actually looking at when we talk about being able to manage at the standards and look at it. Those standards are in rule right now, and they have not changed. What the health department does relative to new science and new health limits is what has changed, and that is their role in their job. And what we then do is try to help those landfill owners adjust to those ongoing health limits. And that's the role we play through the permitting. The bottom of page 23.
Excuse me, Ms. Hallbeck, Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Hallbeck, I have a couple questions on this. When you say compliance is met at less than 90% of the solid waste facilities, well, how much less is that?
Ms. Hallbeck.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, if you look at the fourth bullet on that same one, it's probably not written as correctly as it could be, but 22 of the 28 permitted landfills have issues with the health risk limit. So that would be the compliance.
Representative Wagenius.
So, Mr. Chair, that's substantially less. That's like 85% don't meet. Is that what I'm reading? Am I getting this correctly?
Ms. Hallbeck.
Apologize, Mr. Chair.
That's okay. You're all right.
The first part of the compliance is they're above the intervention limit. So 10% of them are above the intervention limit. That's the compliance. And then the next version is a smaller set of those have issues with the health risk.
Follow-up. Representative Wagenius.
Yes. Okay, now I see what you're saying, but this could be more artfully written so that people would understand it a little bit better. When you say compliance with the standards, I'm assuming you're meaning open landfills here and not closed landfills, or are you meaning both?
Ms. Hallbeck.
Mr. Chair, Representative, this is open landfills.
Okay. Follow-up, Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have similar figures for closed landfills.
Ms. Hallbeck.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, I do believe the program does have those numbers. I don't have them off the top of my head.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think it would be helpful to know if we, I'm sure there's some numbers, and I'd like to know whether they're numbers that are gleaned from modeling or actual measurement. And the reason I bring that up, Mr. Chairman, you'd be interested in, is the Washington County landfill when it was leaking. The assumption was made that the plume was, and it would be interesting to hear this at some point, the plume was like this, and indeed the plume was like this. And it went in a whole new direction than people expected. So modeling is not as helpful. I mean, it's a good thing to do, but that was an example of something not working.
Well, Representative Wagenius, we found out how slippery the product is that they use to make silicone or the Scotchgard products, excuse me. And we found out that so slippery it can slide uphill, it seemed like. So, great point. Is that it, Representative Wagenius? Or follow-up, Representative Wagenius?
If I could on this one, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't know what satisfactory progress means in increasing the number of landfills with active gas control.
Ms. Hallbeck.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, because gas control is not an automatic requirement in the solid waste rules, it is one of the ways that you can mitigate groundwater impacts with VOCs, and you can mitigate damage as it flows across. So satisfactory means we are looking at all of the open ones. We're moving them in the direction, but we're really starting at the largest ones and the ones closest with population next to them. Because as gas migrates, you become a safety risk. And so it really is the combination of groundwater and gas collection that we even control both the gases as they migrate and become a safety hazard and gases as they move in. Methane can either go up into the air or it can actually end up in the groundwater. And so it's with gas vents and groundwater that we manage the two together.
Representative Wiginius.
My one more follow-up.
Yes. No, you're fine.
The last one. I don't know that this includes fine particulate or not, and the ozone things that we're worried about and are on the brink of being non-compliant. But it does seem that if we are going to deal with climate change gases, dealing with these would be critical. And so it feels like this should be far more of a priority than I am hearing from this testimony.
Comment, Ms. Halbe?
I think that's a good comment. We'll take back to the program.
Thank you. Representative Jaskolski, you had a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks again, Ms. Halbeck. Ms. Halbeck, on page 19, I'm running a little bit behind your presentation here, but you're talking about greenhouse gas inventory and says implement guidance for GHG review and environmental review for all projects by January 1st, 2010. So there has been some sort of guidance there. I'm just wondering. So, are we including carbon dioxide emissions in the environmental review now? Is that what that's saying,
Ms. Halbach?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, we do look at what we anticipate they generate and what that relates to the ongoing models that are happening at the federal level. In that, there is no standard. It's really about understanding what's happening with that facility and having them look at, are there modifications that they can make that works within their project. So it's really about, which is what the environmental review process is understanding what's happening with the facility, where we are, and can the facility make changes. That's really what's happening with it.
Mr. Chair.
Follow-up, Representative Jaskolski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Halbach. So I mean, carbon dioxide is treated in that case as a pollutant in the whole scheme of the environmental review evaluation. Is that what we're doing? And then what limitations or directions is the project proposal? What type of limitations are placed on the proposal because of that?
Ms. Halbach.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I did one of the first projects that we actually did this on, which was an ethanol plant, and it really was just the understanding there were no limits placed upon it. It was being able to compare what that ethanol plant was doing with its, by using propane, by using natural gas as energy sources, how they were managing the facility compared if they were using coal or they were using a different source. There were no additional parameters put on them. It was really the understanding provided. So it wasn't treated any more than that.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Jaskolski.
Ms. Halbach, so and I look forward to kind of receiving your overview of where your agency's authority comes in each of these areas, and I know you'll cover that area, but I'm curious, do you know offhand where the authority for your involvement in doing that comes from for that activity?
Ms. Halbach.
Mr. Chair, Representative, it comes from two. One is the court cases that we've been involved with on environmental review that told us to look at the comprehensive nature of the potential pollutants that come from a facility and to do it. Secondly, because we are the implementing agency for the federal government in this area to do. And the third one was what we understood our role to be from the Next Generation Energy Act.
Mr. Chair, one more question.
Representative Jaskolski.
Thank you, and thank Ms. thanks, Ms. Halbach. So the next page, two pages ahead, 21, on the bottom, you talk about the Minnesota Climate Change Advisory Group. It appears, as I read this, is guiding or maybe provides the baseline from your activity there. I'm curious what and I remember last year hearing some things about them on this committee. What authority do they have, and what is their relationship in that authority with your agency?
Ms. Halbach.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the group no longer exists. It was a group brought together by Governor Pawlenty to look at these issues, and they issued a number of advisories. It's part, again, of when that Next Generation Energy Act passed and what we were all trying to do. So it doesn't have authority over it. It's another area where we got data, science, and information that, as an agency dealing with the environment, we make proactive decisions from that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Ms. Halbach.
Continue, Ms. Halbach.
Okay, I'm at the bottom of page 23. This area is talking about our underground storage tank and above ground storage tanks, but the majority of tanks in Minnesota are underground. Imagine most of our independent gas stations have underground tanks. This again comes from the Federal Energy Act and the federal laws that, and we also have rules that we have to inspect them, but the goals on the inspection come from the federal government to us. And we're required to inspect every 3 years every tank in Minnesota. We're part of the way through that to do, and that will provide us what we do. What we have found through the economic recession was that these stations turned over more often than they had in the past. So we had new owners on a much more regular basis coming in, and they didn't actually know what was required of them because you have a new training session to do. And so we put some training online. We're trying to provide through our inspections more of that assistance and working with them. And we really need to, particularly with in the metropolitan area and some of the others, figure out how to reach them before they have problems. But this is really a preventative program so that their tanks aren't leaking petroleum into the soil below and eventually groundwater. And then we have the Cleanup Act after that, where the petroleum tax that's on the gas that you buy pays 90% to clean it up. So we're trying to do, again, the prevention part up front so we don't have to do the cleanup at the back end of it. And eventually we believe that. We are seeing in the number of cleanups that we have to do, it is on the decline. And so we hope to, again, work ourselves out of the cleanup program by preventing.
Representative Beard.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members, just to this point, I wish Mr. Krogman was here to speak to this. Because this tax was, as I mentioned in the last committee, there is a nexus, a connection you can make between gasoline tax and automobile travel in this case, which is allowed, I think, to avoid a real constitutional challenge as long as it remains connected to cleaning up these service stations. There had been an idea floated that maybe we were going to extend the sunset and divert this money to some other purposes. I just want to let you know that I have real problems with that, and as we move forward, we'll want to have that discussion and probably have some other people that also are very interested and conversant with this program come to the table and talk about that. For instance, it's very difficult for these small service station operators to get insurance to protect their tanks. This is the state-run program that was created by people who've gone before us to help accommodate that and help protect the groundwater and the economic livelihoods of people who are in the petroleum business. So I just want to make sure that we know that there are issues around this before we deflect these funds or attempt to another direction. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Beard. And we did have that discussion. This is a program that's run jointly with Commerce and MPCA. And if I'm not mistaken, I believe Representative either, I think it's Representative Hackbart has a bill to extend that, if I remember right. Mm-hmm. And we will be hearing that bill when we get through our budget overviews. Continue, Ms. Hallback.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So on page 24, again, this is, we talked briefly, so I'll just quickly move over. This was, we had talked about the hazardous waste generators, and we had mentioned household hazardous waste. This is our work with the business generators and what we can do to move them. And we would, again, we're looking at how we target that in working with our watersheds or where there might be PFC-related issues, and make sure that those areas are in compliance and move. In the metro area, most of that inspection and work is done by the metropolitan counties. Our staff work in the non-metro, and there's only about six staff that we have. So we really do target it, do most of this work with information and assistance to do. The bottom of that page we did talk about already, really, with the household hazardous waste program. So I don't believe I need to talk about that again. And so on page 25 is where we're, the first one about reducing the number of sites in the Superfund program. Again, the goal is to get us out of having to manage sites. that we're able to delist the site and say it is cleaned up good enough, and that it can be put back into productive use. So you'll see the number of sites and our status. We have 23 we're still investigating. We got 13 in an active remediation, and 51 that we still have to ongoing operation and maintenance in order to manage the risks around there. And we closed out 8. Our goal is 10 per year. We only got 8. But again, we're moving those to the completed list. And that's where we all should be headed. Page 26. At the top of that, the heading is at the bottom of the other page. That didn't turn out as well. But this is the leaky underground tank program that we were just talking about on the cleanup part of it. And again, for us, we have 120 days to finish every one that we're working on when we have the responsible party coming forward and saying, here, we've got an issue. And so our work should take no more than 120 days. We also do cleanup at the federally regulated programs on behalf of them to do, and we're trying to get that land back into productive use. Again, getting us out of it. And just for the record, our part of to extend the sunset date on the petroleum is only for the use of this program. That's our request, is to extend it so we can do the cleanups and finish them. The next one is completing the construction at our closed landfills. There are 112 in the program. There are two that are yet to come in the metropolitan area that are fairly significant, one being Freeway Landfill in Burnsville. That one will probably take a few years to come into the program, and it will have a significant cost to it when it's in the program. The other one is the Flying Cloud Landfill. Flying Cloud will be in the program this summer. We will be able by 2015 with the current funding that we are proposing and maybe one more bond session to complete construction at all of those but Freeway by 2015. And so that's what yesterday when we were talking about the impact of the environmental fund transferring to remediation.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is, during this cleanup period, if there's someone that still owns the property and so forth, are they being fined for on a daily basis until that cleanup happens, or does that all come out of the Superfund? How does that work?
Ms. Hallback.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we do not issue penalties for this. The state program is somewhat different than the federal program. We moved in a proactive basis, which is why we've really cleaned up more sites in Minnesota than the others. We decided not to do it through litigation, but through cooperation. And so our responsible parties in Minnesota have stepped up and done their part, and we have taken on the part where really, as a society, we use the sites or we manage the sites, and so we do work that together. Part of our funding in the remediation fund goes to those properties that where there is no responsible party anymore. It changed hands long ago, and no one really owns that land. And so that is the part where we take total control and clean it up.
Ms. Hallback, along these lines, do you have a, or if you don't know it, or if you could get back to us, at one time there was an aggressive effort by the state to go after people that had used these landfills and go after their insurance companies. And most of us that were business owners that used landfills for different purposes over the years were approached and to find out what we dumped there and how it was used to see if there was an opportunity for the state to collect money from our insurance companies. How much did those efforts get from the insurance companies of the companies using those facilities? And is that program, did I hear you say yesterday that's completely done? You're not pursuing that anymore? And would that mean you've already gotten money for, like, the Burnsville landfill from people that use that?
Mr. Chair, I don't want to speak. There's a number rattling in my head about how much we've recovered from the insurance. We originally thought we'd maybe recover $1 to $3 million, and it's significantly more than that. Last year we deposited $9 million into it. We have completed going aggressively after the insurance companies, and we did that on the behalf of everyone who used the landfill. So rather than at the start of that, folks may know that there was an approach in some states to go after the individual citizen and have them pay a portion of the landfill that they used by landfill owners. What this state did to avoid that is really think about how, as a society, we use that. And so that's how the closed landfill program came into being. And then recover from the insurance companies. We are done, for the most part, with the litigation. There's some payments coming in, but we're done with the litigation part of it.
And Ms. Hallback, again, you said, was it $1 to $3 million or $1 to $3 billion?
Mr. Chair, we thought we might recover $1 to $3 million, and we've recovered significantly more than that.
And Ms. Hallback, when you say significantly more than that, this recovery started decades ago, and did you say just last year you recovered $9 million? So rather than dwell on this, if you could get us some more information. And then just curiosity, how much of the closed landfill cost were the insurance monies able to be? What part of that solution were they? And if you could get us that information. Because I'm assuming if it was $9 million last year, a few decades ago, it was substantially more than that.
Mr. Chair, we'll get you the information. We do an annual report from the closed landfill program on that. But the insurance recovery didn't start decades ago. We started this whole program 2 decades ago. And it was after we were in it for a while that we actually started the insurance recovery. But there is a fairly healthy chunk of dollars that we were able to recover, and it did go to the construction. And so we'll provide you that number.
Thank you. Representative Wiginius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a note on that. I think the closed landfill program didn't start until 1994. And I think the insurance recovery in gross was over $100 million. It'd be good to get the actual figures.
Well, Representative Wiginius, your institutional knowledge is probably good enough for me, but if you want more information, we can have the agency work on it. I was just curious, kind of a ballpark. So thank you. Representative Wiginius, can you pull your mic down a little bit? Thank you.
Thank you. I'm looking at the measures and outcomes that you have where you don't have results in the results box. So collect and destroy 26 million pounds of methane per year, prevent 9 million gallons of ground leachate from reaching groundwater. How much of that is done and how much is left to be done? Or has none of it been done?
Ms. Hallback.
Mr. Chair, And Representative Wiginius's numbers are the numbers that were rolling in my head for the 100 million, but I didn't want to speak out of turn, and so she knows these numbers as good as any of us, so that's good. We have actually, I referenced the closed landfill report because it does have the numbers of the million gallons and the leachate, and it has that. Much of the work has been done. The difficulty, Representative Wiginius, is to actually think of how much do we have to pull up to do. And that is part of the analysis the program is doing right now, because it's trying to do land use planning with the communities it's in, and when can those communities expect these landfills not to be as risky as they are now, and where would you put development near it? Should it be an industrial one? As you know, some of these landfills are sitting in the middle of highly populated areas. And so that is the sort of estimates our engineers in the program are working on.
Thank you. Follow-up, Representative Wiginius.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. The whole purpose of doing the landfill program was not to have land for communities to use, but to make sure stuff didn't get in the groundwater. So that is the most critical measure. Back then, we didn't understand about methane the way we do now. So it seems to me we should, as part of your results, it would be really helpful to have this included, even though it's in another report.
Ms. Hallbeck.
Mr. Chair, that is a good comment, and before we post this on our web, we will add it here.
Thank you. Representative Qualm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to understand, how did you destroy, what was the method of destroying the 26 million pounds of methane, and you know, how much useful energy and activity did we gain from that?
Representative Qualm, I think Representative Beard told us earlier about it's not necessarily all destroyed, that some of it is generating power. Ms. Hallbeck.
Mr. Chair, Representative, it is, we're, our goal is actually to try to capture all of it to generate power. But it is very difficult to do it at the very small landfills, and so in some of those cases it's just flared, so it's burned. But again, I'll go back and provide you that from the report, because that's exactly what our program reports on, is how much of that is turned into energy and how much is captured.
So, Ms. Hallbeck, it's better to ignite it. That's where I know I've seen that going by some landfills, you see. So from a polluting standpoint, it's better to ignite it than to just let it go into the air?
Yes.
Thank you. Representative Beard, Representative Qualm, follow-up?
No, that was
okay. Good. Thank you. Representative Beard.
Well, Mr. Chairman, that was exactly where I was going to go with the destruction of 26 million pounds of methane, to know that there, to note for the committee, there actually is very useful work being done with that methane, and I hope, and this is new to me, this committee, Mr. Chairman, I hope going forward landfill design is actually implemented with just those things in mind, that they're designed so that we can actually treat our landfills, become treatment centers where we can actually do useful stuff with the things that are decomposing, like, for instance, generate electricity with the methane and collect the leachate and do something useful with it other than just let it lay in the ground. So thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Qualm was right on point.
Well, and Representative Beard, that capture will be much easier now, as many of the facilities are lined facilities with different kind of capture ability. Continue, Ms. Hallbeck.
Mr. Chair, at the bottom of 26 starts our discussion on the voluntary investigation and cleanup program. And in this case, and you'll see it when we do the governor's initiatives, we're reducing, we're actually asking for reduction in the appropriation here. We've had a reduction in the staff. We've moved those to help with the underground storage tank cleanup because we, again, in the economy and the recession, there were less development of property going on. So rather than having staff here waiting for people coming in, we moved them over to the cleanup program, which is very similar, does the investigation. In the case for us here, this, our work in this area is really to review the reports that are done by the development companies and their consultants so that we can issue that clean bill of health and that the land is developable. And that's done on a fee per service, and it's also done with some of the money from the federal government and a small appropriation from us. So it's a combination of three funding sources that keep the people available to help do those reviews and work with it. And folks in St. Paul will probably remember that the Phelan Corridor was, that is really a brownfield that went under this program, was redeveloped and reconstructed into profitable land. That's that ends up our land description, and on page 27 we would start with water to move, and the first goal we have in water is really about assessing the conditions of Minnesota groundwater system, and this work is funded not only with federal funds but general fund, clean water fund money, and the environmental fund. So we did try to highlight the sorts of things we were doing under the measures and outcomes that are the base effort, and then the sort of work that's happening under the Clean Water Fund to, again, as you know, the supplement issue. We do try to track that, both in the work we're doing, what was the base, and then also in the funding. So in this area, this is the groundwater and focusing on vulnerable aquifers in the non-agricultural areas first, because that begins to be drinking water sources for folks. And we had we just signed contracts and we're installing wells. And those wells will be installed by June of this year. And that will allow us now to have a groundwater monitoring network by which we can assess across the state, both here, and then we utilize existing wells to do in the non-populated areas. So we have volunteers who work with us, and we utilize Department of Natural Resource wells, and we use the Department of Ag wells that they have. So we don't reinstall where we already have wells to do this.
Ms. Halbeck, excuse me. Representative Parkelson. Continue, Ms. Halbeck.
So with that, we will
I'm sorry. My eyes are getting bad. Representative Qualm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm curious about when we have farms and other places that have non-potable wells, and you know their utilization. Do you have a program to periodically take samples with those, since they tend to, you know, maybe be in an agricultural or a business location, and that way you'd have a quicker turnaround on issues?
Fallback.
Mr. Chair, we do work with farms in this network. That work began actually in the 90s, so some of them are part of this system. And that's where that data is in with the Minnesota Health Department data, because the farmers are routinely taking it. But we know about the wells and their length and where they fit into the aquifer as well. That's why I say the wells that are being installed under this are to augment what's already there and not duplicate it so that we can do it.
Continue, Ms. Halbeck.
Moving to page 28, Mr. Chair. And at the top of that, where we have a groundwater condition report that's due by December 31st, 2012. It is that report that is based on the wells that we are installing and with the analysis that's going on. And from there, then we will have a sense of where the state needs to go to really protect on an ongoing basis groundwater. So we do not have objectives in this area until we complete that report and really know what the report tells us and what we might or might not have to do in the case. The second one is really down in W1C is what are those best management practices in the existing programs we have that could prevent or protect against this. And there are some data gaps in this, particularly as our stormwater folks are looking at it. And as we want stormwater to infiltrate and not run off the land, it is what happens when that stormwater moves through the soils and reaches groundwater. Have we just changed where the impacts are from surface water to groundwater? And that is often the case of what you're looking at in the environmental field. If you make one choice, have you moved the problem? And so what is the risk associated? What guidance can you give rather than just don't have it run off? What is it about the infiltration? How can you manage it? And so we are doing that. The other part of this program is really to look at, again, where cities have stormwater ponds and they're collecting sediment into it, what leaches through those ponds, what's in the sediment, and what are opportunities really for us to manage that in a better way. So that is part of this. Once we have some of those gaps completed with our research, then we can really talk about what are the goals and achievements that we want in prevention.
Representative Wagenia.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You didn't use the word coal tar here, and I thought I would be hearing the word coal tar.
Ms. Hallback.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, we did not use the word coal tar, although that is part of the investigation and what we're trying to manage around. But we're trying to look at the broader suite, not just coal tar, to do.
Continue, Ms. Hallback.
Mr. Chair, at the bottom of page 28, goal W2, which is really the assessment on our lake streams and wetlands, so this is the above groundwater, if you want to dictate it as that. And again, we tried to do the same thing, is to show you what was the base effort, what was going on before, and what is happening with the Clean Water Fund. And you see our sampling is on track. We are getting the sampling, so it will be on the 10-year track. What we're finding right now is with the volunteers and the additional sampling, we're not quite keeping up in getting the assessment part done. So we're having the data come in. That's a good thing. So we signed a contract with a couple of University of Minnesota students to develop really an automated assessment. So to take the factors of what we need to do, and rather than have each individual be able to load in the data from it and process it quicker. That information and that assessment is due whether you're a watershed person or we're moving into the TMDL. We really need the assessments to understand what it is we're trying to do, and whether the rivers, lakes, or streams are actually impaired, or we need to just protect them. And so that's the part that we're not quite on track, but we believe if we can get the program set up, we'll process the data and still stay on track for the rest of the work.
Thank you. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Hallback, as you do these measurements, and I think many of us are very aware of the efforts of the agencies around TMDLs and how it affects our constituencies. One of the things that the agency has not answered yet in this whole area is the whole area of background levels. And so my question is, as you go out and do these, are there efforts to ascertain, I don't know scientifically exactly how that's done, but we go out and measure things, but we don't know how they were, before man got there. And that's probably getting out of your area, but I'm wondering if that is a conscious part of this activity.
Ms. Hallback.
Mr. Chair, I can't answer the how, but I can answer that, yes, indeed, it is part of what we're trying to do.
Continue, Ms. Hallback.
Mr. Chair, I'm now at the bottom of page 29. This is the part that actually gives us the background information for the lakes and streams. So what is there so that we're able to compare those lakes and streams that don't have a lot of us around it to those lakes and streams where we have a lot of either growth, agricultural, urban areas, But what are the differences between those so that we can start to look at both regions of the state and what the water is, and then what happens with human activity around it? So it's part of this data that allows us to do the how and the analysis.
Thank you. Representative Qualm.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Harbath. On these, I'm assuming that you do take into account flood occurrences and the pulsing and spiking that can occur. Do you also do core borings of sediment to try and get a overtime baseline on some of the contaminants? Not all are going to settle into the sediment, but you might be able to have an idea over time. I mean, and then how do you account for, as you're sampling, do you go back and do a summer, spring, and fall so you get the effects of, you know, the rain, the, you know, have a better full picture so that if you do a sample randomly, that you know that it's going to be X percent greater because of the conditions it was taken in?
Ms. Hallbeck.
Mr. Chair, Representative Qualm, we do all of those, but it isn't necessarily spring, fall, and winter that will have the impact. But the reason that our staff are out there trying to monitor all year round to the extent they can. So core monitoring might occur in the winter so they can get out there. But we also have larger boats where we go out and do core. And we usually assist the experts in it. So some of the universities and the USGS have more of the experts in that. But we do try to do the trend analysis, which is why we don't make decisions just on one sample that we get or one sampling year, because it is the trend, as you say, that informs us really when there's an impact.
Representative Call.
Yes, how many limnologists do you have in your area, or are they primarily in the DNR and other groups?
Ms. Hallbeck.
Mr. Chair, I don't know the exact number of limnologists, but we do have limnologists on the staff. But we do partner with the other ones so that we can share the understanding and the learning of everybody, so they have their expertises.
Thank you.
Continue, Ms. Hallbeck.
Moving to page 30, the top of page 30. Again, part of our monitoring is in agreement with the federal government and what they have for states doing, and so we are part of a national effort to understand wetlands and what those do, and so we're completing work on a three-year monitoring cycle that EPA has funded, and our staff are participating. Really, we don't know, and you know, the scientists back at the agency won't, that's not their job to guess what the results of it are going to be. They're waiting for the data, and then they'll do the assessment and put it in. So we're on track to complete that, but we really need the data and the analysis before we know what might be the appropriate action in wetlands. How do they fit into the overall ecosystem? We know that they're an important part in our surface water ecosystem, but just exactly what do we need to do from that? And that, of course, will include DNR as wetland experts to look at it from a habitat point of view and as well as water quality. The next portion of this is looking at impaired waters, and we are redesigning the program really to think about it as a watershed. And doing the work on a watershed basis rather than each impairment individually. If you do each impairment and did a TMDL on each impairment, first of all, it will take a long time to go through it. Secondly, your fix on the impairment won't happen at that impairment alone. You really need to look at the watershed. And so we're really designing this so that we can do a watershed look, figure out where it needs to be protected, where we need to restore, and where we should focus first. So those are called priority management zones that we've been working with it. And then engaging the locals really on what's needed to do in that area. And then again, it's easier on a watershed basis.
Thank you. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Hallbeck, excuse me, can you give me the agency's definition of an impaired water?
Ms. Hallbeck.
I'll give you the shorthand because I don't work in the program.
We like shorthand.
You're not meeting water quality standards.
Follow-up. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Hallbeck, and so what's the baseline? Can we get the information? What's the baseline for not meeting for those standards that you speak of?
Ms. Hallbeck.
Mr. Chair, Representative, it's our water quality rules, and so, again, we have standards for the various streams and rivers and lakes, depending on where they're located and what the quality of it is. Standards are based for the use of the water. And so we can provide you kind of that guidance, but that's where you start. That's where the analysis looks to, are they meeting those standards? So when we do the assessment, it's about meeting the standard of that water for its use.
So, Ms. Hallbeck, you do impaired water for turbidity, you do impaired water for mercury, and they're measured by how, for instance, in those two cases?
Well, mercury, for all of them, because we do mercury across the state, and so that was a very unique one. So you have to analyze for mercury in the water. So the how is beyond my expertise.
But, Ms. Hallbeck, what I was getting at, isn't it so many parts per some kind of a unit, and if it's above that, it's considered impaired. If it's below that, it's got a different definition. So you use a parts per whatever?
Yes, and depending on what you're looking at, it'll be parts per million, parts per billion. So the standard is really about health, environmental risk, and then use of the water.
And turbidity would be clearance or ability with the Secchi disc to see something at a certain distance?
Mr. Chair, I apologize.
No, you're okay. You want to move it along. I'm not going to argue with you.
We are changing the way we do that, but you're correct. Turbidity is based on the clarity of the water, and we're really trying to move it to a more science-based on what's in it. So what type of soil is in it, what's creating the lack of clarity in the water.
Thank you. Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Perhaps you anticipated my question about mercury. Just a general comment in this area where standards revolve around fishable, swimmable. And the fishable portion of that, my question was if indeed mercury is included in generically in this impaired waters, because I believe all Minnesota waters are impaired for fishability to some degree because of the mercury in the fish, and I believe the primary measurement of that is in the fish as opposed to in the water, the fish tissue, usually a part per billion. But is this generically included in this impaired waters, Ms. Hallbeck?
Ms. Hallbeck.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, it is. We did the first statewide TMDL, and we did it on mercury. And that is actually why the mercury reduction, for the most part, is needed in the power plants, and the other is because in that study we found that mercury in the water is really less about the discharge to the water and more about air deposition. And so we really need to look at those types of activities.
Thank you. Continue.
Again, as I was talking, as we do the TMDL and we base on watershed, we are then looking at how we do permitting relative to watershed and how we can streamline and focus even our compliance stormwater areas. And so we are in the method of moving our programs to really looking in the water area on the watershed and focusing completely that way. And that will take a little adjustment to do. What that will allow us to make sure the TMDL stay on the 10-year cycle with the monitoring program. Not only is it to get them started within that 10-year cycle, but it is to complete a TMDL within 3 years after we start it. Some of the larger ones, like Lake Pepin, take multiple years. But in the lower Minnesota River Basin, where we were able to do a watershed permit to lower phosphorus, we've been able to improve by using trading results, by having the communities actually look at prevention within themselves. And so watershed really does energize the group in there to manage as a group and not individuals looking at the solution. So we really do think that's the way to garner the most bang for the buck under the legacy dollars that we have. Moving again to page 31 then, W3, which is the protection of it, and W3A is really where we do our triennial review, which is looking at the water quality standards and looking at the standards on whether they should be adjusted. Now, some of that we know from the science as we're gathering it. Some of it is what does the federal government look at to us to have as standards. And so currently we're in one of the triennial reviews. They're to occur every 3 years, as the name imposes. The one we're looking at right now includes non-degradation. What does that mean to the state? In our last review, that took quite some issues on it. And then we're looking at, with Clean Water Funds, we had some dollars to really look at nitrogen and how we look at nutrients in the water. And so that's part of the current triennial review that's going on. And we'll be a little behind. We're about 6 months behind. And then with that, we're trying to look at how we can move through those reviews on a quicker approach, because it really does matter having the right standard for the White River and what people do relative to that. So again,
excuse me, Ms. Halbach. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Halbach, there under 3A, you talk about setting water quality standards and rule revisions of new standards. What's the, again, in the Cliff Notes version, what's the process for setting the rules? Is there input? I realize it's based on science and so forth, but what's the input that you take from that? Is it from the legislature? Is it from groups?
Ms. Halbach.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we first look at the science, but then we, under the Administrative Procedures Act of rulemaking in Minnesota, we seek out everybody and take input from anyone. And that really is the process we're entering in now. So we take the science and develop what we think is the standard and the language around that. We put together what is called a statement of need and reasonableness, which is the justification for that standard. The science is part of it. And then we take that out to the public. We have public hearings, we have public meetings. So we've included, in this case, the public all along the process. So we've had meetings kind of at steps along the way so that no one really should be surprised by the draft rule. That's our goal. But then we have formal public hearings where people can bring in before a judge. And then we look at that information, and then we make the final determination. So it's a fairly lengthy rulemaking, but it includes everyone in the process, anyone who wants to participate.
Follow-up? Representative Jaskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I caught a lot of what was just said, but will there be new, are they considering new impairment categories to, again, expand the reach and tentacles of the agency to again, further regulate our waters?
Ms. Halbach.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we don't do impairment categories. If there is a standard and the analysis shows that the reach is not meeting the standard, then it is impaired by definition. And so what we look to do is find the right standard, as Representative Purzell said, for fishable and swimmable and the use of the water body. Once that standard is set, the analysis is compared to that standard. But in the case of chloride in a couple of years ago, we actually changed the standard that raised the limit of it. The question around wild rice and the sulfate standard is that standard based 1973 the right standard? And that's what the science and the rule process let us do.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Jaskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it sounds like there is not an effort to create new impairment categories, because I know at one time we were looking at phosphates and nitrates and coliform were kind of the three that that we went by, and then suddenly at one point we expanded the impairment categories to include, is it fishable, is it swimmable, is there turbidity? I don't know. There's probably some others I'm not aware of. So what I'm hearing is there are not additional impairment categories like those being proposed to be added at this time. Is that accurate?
Ms. Hallback.
Mr. Chair, again, we're not looking to include new categories, but fishable, swimmable is your first standard. And under there, you analyze whether it's fishable or swimmable, whether fecal coliforms are in the water. So that's already has a standard. So if you violate that standard, the assessment shows that that river or stream or lake is over the standard on a regular process, it's by definition impaired. And the same is true for turbidity, and the same is true for phosphorus or nitrogen. So if there is a standard, it's really about whether it's above or below that standard. It's not a new category. So a new one stream may have a fecal coliform impairment, while another one doesn't because it doesn't show up.
But Ms. Hallback, and one I'm familiar with is like the PFBAs, the different components of that. We didn't used to be able to test for those, and we didn't have a standard, or our ability to test was not very sophisticated. As we began to develop the ability to test for that, we understood more about that, and we now have we developed an interim guideline and then modified that when we got more information after testing. I'm wondering if that's along the lines Representative Draskowski's asking about, understanding that your base is considered, you're concerned about the body of water or whatever it is, but don't we add things like that? The Department of Health, working with you, did that. And the chemical I'm talking about is the one that was used in the development of things like Scotchgard and firefighting foam that you talked about earlier and some of the cleanup you're doing. Ms. Hallback.
Mr. Chair, thank you for that observation. Indeed, that was an oversight on my part. But yes, new science may find new things that impact the ability, again, for fishable and swimmable. And so that would, when a new standard would be created, that could create a new impairment category. But we're doing it based on the science and what we're knowing, not just actively trying to find the impairments.
Follow-up, Representative Draskowski.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to take off on your point here a little bit and just kind of rounding some numbers here.
Excuse me, but our takeoffs, and I've been part of those, may lead us to Tuesday evening next week.
I'll do my best here to be.
No, you're all right.
Of the roughly 80,000 chemicals we use in commerce, we know something about 2,500 or so. And this is part of the reason why, as we come to understand and even be able to measure, as you alluded to analytically, some of these chemicals that are used in commerce, we find out there's bad news, and so we revisit that in the best interest of human health and the environment. So that's going to be a moving target.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, basically here, when we say fishable, we want to make sure the fish have something to eat, and they grow up healthy, and the little boy fish don't turn into little girl fish. How are we doing for an index of biologic integrity? That would make sure that there's the right food in the water, the plankton is there, et cetera. Do we have a good standard now, or is that still being developed?
Ms. Hallback.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, I can't answer that question today, but we will get that answer for you.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Follow-up, Representative Wagenius.
Yes, I mean, basically, that's what we're looking for. You know, it's not how much phosphorus it is. You know, we could reduce the phosphorus, and the little fish might not be healthy. but I wish Representative Hackbarth was here because we're doing this all for him, right?
Well, Representative Wagenius, I think we're also doing it for former Representative Cy Tao, who many of his friends spend days down in Hastings on the shores catching white bass, or commonly called silver bass, and we want to make sure that they're safe to eat in the proper numbers. So I think it's for many folks, including many that come to Hastings and fish the area downriver of the Twin Cities area. Representative Wagenius.
Thank you. We're downriver from Hastings, where they were finding, I think, 83% of the bass. Maybe it was 73%. But anyway, big number of the bass were the little boy fish were becoming little girl fish. I was being a little flip before, so I want to make sure that the other thing, of course, is human health here. And a lot of Minnesotans drink surface water, probably about 25% of them. And to the extent that that water gets dirty, we spend a ton of money cleaning it up. And so there are a lot of citizens in Minnesota that depend on our water. So it's not just fishable, swimmable. It's fishable, swimmable, drinkable.
And Representative Wagenius, when you say they drink the surface water, you're not alluding to like we used to do when I was a kid, and we would literally drink it out of the water wherever we were. You're alluding to like the city of Minneapolis where you live, where they take water out of the Mississippi River, treat it, and then you get that out of your tap, as opposed to Hastings where we drill a hole in the ground and our water comes from that way. Representative Wagenius.
Mr. Chair, you're correct. And one of the problems here is that because Minneapolis takes its water from the Mississippi River, our water, while it's quite good, is the most expensive drinking water in the state because it has to be treated. And so folks in Hastings who can drill into the Mount Simon, I imagine, don't have to spend so much money treating their water. One of the problems for the rest of Minnesota is as the groundwater becomes contaminated, you look at your small cities out there, they're having to clean up. They're all going to become like Minneapolis because we're not protecting our groundwater. And that's an expensive proposition for Minnesotans. Down in your area, I suspect it's going to be a very expensive proposition. I don't know about some of the others, but yours would be karst and expensive.
Representative Purcell, who's thank also you. Drank a lot of water right out of the
thank
lake.
Thank you. Thank you. That you're to that point. And I was going to, be a little bit smart and say I was really succinct, but I guess the can of worms got open a little bit, and I won't apologize for that. But I think it's good discussion. I did want to just... to the point about surface water, there are standards, and most poignantly the coliform standard that is set around ingestion by children at swimming beaches, and you can get pretty sick over that stuff. So there are standards that are set around ingestion of surface water, particularly other than like Minneapolis having a drinking water source out of the Mississippi River. Just want to make that point.
Thank you. Continue, Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Since the editorializing has begun, I guess I thought I'd weigh in a little bit. We do know that our surface water qualities have improved as we look at the benchmark studies that have been done in a wide variety of those major measures anyway. And the question, I guess, that we look at, and Mr. Chair, I'm surprised you're living today after drinking that water. Realizing that the Mississippi River was much more impaired when you and I were younger than it is today, And thank goodness in the work that we have done and the policies that we have adopted have provided for that. I think we need to acknowledge that. And the question is, as we go forward, what is the point of diminishing marginal returns as we continue? We could infinitely develop impairment categories in order to move towards what some might want to have appear to be similar to distilled water running down our creeks and streams. But the reality is we can't afford to have distilled water, and incidentally, distilled water does not appear in nature anywhere. There are normal chemicals that run in our water if there was not a single person on the planet. I think we need to acknowledge that, and we need to have a keen eye towards the interface between cleaning up our waters and what we can afford to do.
Representative Drazkowski, I think I've said it before, but I don't know if the freshmen on the committee have heard it. My mother let me do a lot of things outdoors when I was a kid, and I truthfully have put my life and limb at risk. And many of them she allowed me to do. But if I swam in the Mississippi, I had to shower afterwards very quickly. And our river is much, much better today than it was. That's not to say it shouldn't continue to get better, but the vivid memories I have of what it looked like, smelt like, and was like are not there today. Ms. Halbeck, continue.
Mr. Chair, members, we're on the bottom of page 31, objective W3B, which is about our wastewater permitting program and the ability to coordinate that with the impairments and ensuring non-degradation of the state waters. And one of the important parts that we're doing, and we noted a couple of the types of permitting activities and TMDL areas underway relative to those facilities that have a permit, and mercury reduction is one of them. But the other part that we are doing is completing a database and an ability to capture the daily values of our wastewater plants. And the important part of that is it really will allow us to do a better and faster analysis and showing what our facilities are contributing to the loading and what they are doing that it actually shows the reduction component of it. The way it happens now is many of our facilities aren't able to report what happens on a daily basis, so you're doing monthly grabs. And that really does modify the trend in the analysis, as we were talking earlier. This will allow us to look at the compliance components as well, and really know whether it's a blip in the what happened in the entire month or whether it's really an ongoing issue. And so this is a streamlining approach that we've been working on for a couple of years and are nearing completion. And it will also ultimately end up that our facilities will be able to directly report online and again stop sending in paper and have their information back to them in a more real-time basis.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Halbeck, I think I've seen earlier some of the summaries on wastewater of the massive public investment that's been done to make our Mississippi River clean, that the property taxpayers and the folks that have been assessed fees to clean up the river in the metropolitan area, the folks that didn't have best management practices or the voluntary approach, the folks that just had to do it and pay for it. Do you have that data? Could you get us that summary data of kind of the aggregate amount of public investment that's been made from the folks in the metropolitan area to clean up the Mississippi River?
Ms. Halbert.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, we will.
Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Halbeck, are you familiar with the program that PCA and DNR are cooperating with the Shakopee Mdewakanton community and their new wastewater treatment plant? Or can you speak to that at all, or do I need to speak to someone else about it?
Ms. Halbeck.
Mr. Chair, I'm aware of it, but you really need for the details of it to speak to somebody else.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chair, once again, I'll extend the invitation. I actually have it in writing from Chairman Crux at the Mdewakanton community to maybe do a field trip once we get our budget stuff settled here. It is a fascinating technological development. They built it with their own money, and during the tour that I took, at the end of the tour guide actually took a drink of water from the affluent stream. They had applied and I think gotten waivers to actually put the affluent back into the wetland that surrounds a portion of their property. They've been using some of it for irrigation purposes, but they actually have a pilot program, members, where they're actually doing reinjection back into the water table. I know that's sacred ground for some of us, but this is amazing stuff that they actually got. I think it would be a fascinating trip that we could learn from, learn how to innovate in the process, because sometimes we get concerned that the process is so hidebound and so traditional that we can't come outside the box and try new stuff that actually might make the environment better as we live in it. But they're doing it. They're doing it with their own money, and they're anxious to show it to us. Thank you.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just welcome that. I've been there as well, and we would all benefit if we could possibly go out and see this kind of innovation. I couldn't agree more.
Thank you. Ms. Hallbeck, please continue.
Mr. Chair, the rest of that information under there is really about the numbers and the types of permits we'll do. As we move forward and look at this watershed approach, we're going to give you new metrics so that you can see how that is both streamlining it and getting results for it. So right now, these objectives and measures are really about kind of the activities we're doing. So how many permits are we issuing? What is the other? While that is important, you need to be able to put that in some perspective of what's happening at the back end of it and what we're doing. So we want to be able to combine that. And that's really part of what our new databases will allow us to do. So I'm moving on to page 33, Mr. Chair, which is strengthening our program relative to the subsurface soil treatment areas and SSTS and working with our county partners there, particularly in those areas that are threatening public health and safety. That's the priority area. And our goal is to move that from the estimated 39% right now to 5% by 2014. And that goal is really based on a study that was done a few years ago that had a 10-year plan laid out. And you will see that our proposal has money in the Clean Water Fund to really advance this and accelerate it so we can meet that goal and work with the counties. And part of the county need is the resource part for their staffing to work in their county on their needs in the priorities that they find relative to this. The cleanup dollars, the actual repair effort of it, would be with Bowser under those grant programs. So it's really much like we do with the feedlot program, where we would provide the county resource and the technical assistance working with them, and the cleanup portion of that or the remediation really is with the Bowser program. So with that, I would like to jump to page 35, Mr. Chair. And this is our stormwater program, where we're really trying to figure out with municipalities and what options they have. And currently, we permit them. And with the new census, there would be more facilities required to obtain municipal stormwater permits, as that's based on a population and a density area. And we want to find those types of solutions that municipalities can employ that are best management practices that don't move stormwater issues from surface water to groundwater. And the discussion with Coal Tar is really part of this program and understanding where it is. And if cities are putting in ponds to collect sediment and take sediment out of that discharge, that we haven't created another problem for them, both a problem in the groundwater resources, but also their management of those sediments. They have nowhere but a hazardous waste facility to go to, that increases the cost of those in that treatment option. So we are really looking at a couple pilots right now to look at whether we can land spread it, whether it can be in a landfill, just what are those options. Earlier with the University of Minnesota, we thought we could do composting. The first analysis of that doesn't look like it's there yet. That doesn't mean it won't be there in the future. But we really need to find those options for municipalities so that they can work forward with us.
Ms. Halbeck, mm-hmm. along these lines of stormwater and of septic wastewater treatment, do you have any ongoing efforts to identify contamination, cross-contamination within the system where septic wastewater might be getting into our stormwater systems?
Mr. Chair, that kind of work would really be at the county level with where they do it. And, of course, some of them, that cross-contamination happens with tiling. So straight the pipe from SSTS might be connected to a tile outlet. In the case of small communities, they may have the septic tank portion of it, but then they have a straight discharge to the other. The other part of cross-contamination that occurs that we've been finding out with stormwater is as you infiltrate it and you might be near a brownfield, are we actually moving more contaminants from a place that we thought was cleaned up significantly, and we're moving that into groundwater? And so those are part of the research we're trying to understand how this all works together.
So then, Ms. Halbeck, as part of your monitoring, do you actually test for contaminants that may be generated in this manner?
We, Mr. Chair, we do have some pilots where we're trying to look at it, but we're not routinely monitoring that way.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I talked about the municipal stormwater. And, of course, with the stormwater program, you know, there's construction stormwater and there's industrial stormwater. Our construction stormwater program has, so we're never going to be at every construction site, and that isn't what we're designed to do. We're trying to do at the highest risk. We're actively working, for instance, with MnDOT and road projects in the counties so that they know what the BMPs are, and we're just do periodic audits. Visit their sites on that, but we really again want to take our compliance and our looking based on where our watershed TMDL program says the need is there and be able to do focused, not unlike what we do with hazardous waste. When we found out that hospitals were actually mixing hazardous waste with their solid waste and was going to the improper place, we worked with the hospitals on a solution to that. We want to be able to do the same thing with construction and industrial stormwater based on what we know about the watersheds and the priority of the risk. We're never going to have compliance and enforcement staff to be every construction site or every industrial site. So how do we use that in a wiser fashion? And we believe watershed is really the way to do it.
Representative Wagenius, did you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was backtracking a little bit when we were talking about groundwater, and that's my question was, do you test groundwater for viruses?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'd have to go back and ask the groundwater staff for that. We'll get you that answer.
That would be helpful. The Chair and I heard a presentation on what was happening in Wisconsin, and I think none of us had ever associated the word groundwater and virus before, and that was an eye-opener, I would say.
Thank you for bringing that up, Representative. I just reviewed that presentation the other day, and it's something we do need to take a look at. Go ahead, please.
Mr. Chair, I'm on the bottom of page 37 now, and this is Objective W3E, which is about manure management and its potential to impair. You know, we have about 23,000 registered feedlots. 1,100 of those have the federally organized NPDES permit. And what we want to be able to do is use our limited resources to work with the individual farmers and the counties on managing the manure in a proper way. And so that's really where we're going to start to be looking at the compliance trends. We also have the counties in this case doing their inspection and their reporting work directly into Delta now, which is our database for all permits. And so, again, the ultimate is that the counties won't have to do a separate report to us because we'll have it in the database, which will streamline and reduce the reporting requirements of the counties who delegate it with us and work with us. It will also have us be able to focus with them on the highest risk. Again, our efforts in this area will be in the watershed approach effort. And we've done that in a number of the TMDLs where we've had fecal coliform as an issue, and we're able then to prioritize the assistance that many of the farmers want to be able to do. It moves them up into the federal case where they can actually get the grant dollars to help their situation. So we're again taking this and focusing into a watershed approach.
Ms. Hallbeck, I believe I'm probably the only representative at the table that has a manure management plan. And I do annual reporting on how we're applying the manure and to make sure that we're staying with our plan. Are there any plans to make it possible for the user to actually input data directly into this electronic system you're talking about?
Mr. Chair, that's our long-range goal, is to actually do that. You know, we started with the spreadsheet so that electronically, at least at your ownership in your place, you could track it in a five-year along program. And the next step is to be able to take that and put it online. Because that is really what we're trying to do, is streamline it for everybody and stop the paper part of it coming back and forth.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'm on the middle of page 38. And again, all of this really just references what we've been talking about and how do we work on a watershed basis. The bottom part of that is really the TMDL program and the staff delegated to that and maintaining. We have a federal commitment with the dollars that come to us on that side of it to complete our TMDLs as well. So not only are we on track to meet the 10-year cycle along with the assessment that we're doing, we're on track to meet the requirements that the federal government requires of us to get the impairments done. And really, we're on track because we have gone to the watershed approach rather than doing one impairment. This started first, we would do a TMDL for the fecal, and we might come back to that same stretch of river and do it for the phosphorus. When we first started to do all of that impairment issue in one stretch at the time, and now we're looking at the watershed. So really, that is the learning and the streamlining that we're trying to do.
Ms. Hallbeck, could you have any information that would would compare the progress here in Minnesota to other states?
Mr. Chair, I do know the program has that, so we could get that for you. I don't have it in my hands right now.
Thank you. If you could get that to us, please.
Mr. Chair, I think I can be able to move through the next. I'm dropping to page 39 and 40, which are what we call our excellence in operations. And I hope that we could move through these fairly quickly. This is really about being a good organization and managing efficiently and effectively. And so I don't think we have to stop at every one of these, partially because we had some of the conversation yesterday relative to how we manage the fleet and our lease agreements in that. I do want to highlight the first thing on page 40, and that really is about maintaining our staff and having their training done. We have OSHA requirements. Our staff go out and visit sites and to do that. And this is an area where we had fallen a little bit behind, and so we have stepped up our effort and our contract ability. And while we had always thought the state was going to have one contract for us all to use, it's really not as effective that way as we thought it was going to be. And so we're creating a master contract to make sure our training stays on course and our monitoring. So our emergency responders, our hazardous waste inspectors really need to have ongoing training and that inspection. So as an organization, just to let you know that that part of the organization, if you don't monitor it the same way that you monitor permitting and tracking that, you don't keep up with it either. So kind of have to regulate ourselves a little bit.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. The CASTIFIER on that in-service training and such, is some of that outstate or is it all in-state, or how much of each do you do in the agency?
Mr. Chair, we do all of that in-state. We use OSHA that's here, and we use the National Safety Council that's here within the state. We have some online programs we're able to do as well, and so we try to take advantage of all of that in-state. The next page 41, I just want to highlight a little bit that I don't think we're unique in this agency, but we early retirement, we offered some early retirements. We know that we have an aging workforce, and we really need to do the workforce planning that allows us to move into the next generation of workers and where are our knowledge gaps. And so that is an ongoing effort right now. And what part can technology help us with, and what part do we really need new skills into the agency that are leaving us? Page 42 is really aligning, this committee has discussed for a number of years, and we know that the governor and the Department of Administration are looking, and we personally care about, and that's about how do we fiscally account for the work we do? So how do we understand the work we're doing to how we budget, and what are the outcomes we're getting? And we really do have great hopes for the new financial system the state is putting in place to help us connect to our work and the outcomes, and then be able to put that out on the web and be transparent about it. So that's the future direction that we're going. So you might actually see me doing this all from the web in a future presentation. And that you can look at it in real time. So the other day when we had discussions about where did people change and how did they change, you would see that right online and where we moved, had them and where they moved from into. Page 43 is just really about some of the things we've already done. We've upgraded our web. That'll make it better. And it prepares us for doing that online sort of activity. How do we use small business and education? Again, we've talked about those sort of things relative to it. On the bottom of page 44 is about having some data governance and standardization. And we intend to do that both in our environmental databases and in our financial records so we can connect. One of the critical issues for us is to upgrade our legacy databases. And so I use the acronym DELTA, which has all of our permitting and ongoing things. It's now 25 years old and is based on programming that really there aren't the talent out there to get anymore. So it's on a platform, and it's designed in a language that no longer exists. So upgrading it is very difficult. We need to migrate that to a different kind of technology so that it's achievable in an ongoing migration. So we have some of those significant things that will be coming in the future that we'll be planning with now. Really, the next is on the bottom of page 45, and I talked a little briefly about this, about going paperless and being able to public notice online. And I know that there is a bill currently introduced that will allow local governments to do their public noticing online, and we would want to have those same authorities in order to streamline that activity and make it more convenient for people to comment with us. And so we're going to be pursuing that in the next year or two. And I have a couple pilots that we're working on to do. And then again, page 40.
Representative Fabian has a question.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Ms. Hallbeck, in light of the legislative auditor's report with regards to data and so forth, I think it would be helpful for this committee to make sure that we get a fairly detailed report of what the agency plans to do with regards to bringing all that data together so it's more accessible, it's more concise, it's more easily retrievable. I think it would be important for you to consider doing some outsourcing to allow people, agents, or companies that do this type of work to help you with that. I think this is a big issue.
Thank you, Representative. I believe we'll be reviewing the legislative auditor's report at a future meeting. Would you like to try and finish this off, please?
Yes, Mr. Chair, and we will be able to finish this. But relative to the representative question, there are two components to it. One, we certainly can tell you what we're doing right now with getting some of that information. We are in the what we call planning stages for the legacy, and much of that changeover will have to be outsourced in order to accomplish it. And that plan, that report, though, would not probably be ready until midsummer, but we can make it available to you, and then perhaps next year be talking to the committee about that.
Thank you.
The last item really is about just overall going paperless and managing the documents in a different way.
Thank you. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Real quickly, thank you. Curious, Ms. Hallbach, where in this administrative area would we find the 27 public information officers in the agency?
They are in here, but I, off the top of my head, can't tell you. They more likely would be in the numbers with the Web 2.0 and the redesign and that, but they are in this part. And there's, we're down to less than 27 now. But
thank you, Ms. Hallbach. A follow-up?
Just quickly, thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Hallbach, could you let us know exactly where they are? Thank you.
Representative Drazkowski, would you care to approve the minutes of the last meeting?
I would. I move the approval of those minutes, Mr. Chair.
Discussion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. The much-rumored Tuesday night meeting is apparently off the table at the moment, so I don't think you need to plan on being here Tuesday night. Instead, plan on being here at our regularly assigned times. This meeting is adjourned.